The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Coming to you from our private MARTA car, we bid you welcome to another incentivized political breakfast. And it's a sumptuous feast this time, to say the least. The continuing legal and political war over the governor's race, runoffs for a couple of other top posts, a special session of the legislature, and, oh yes, a thanks but no thanks from Amazon, followed by the public delivery of the sweeteners Georgia was ready to offer the giant company. I'm Dennis O'Hare. It is good to have you along. Brian Robinson is back with us. He is a Republican strategist and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Democratic strategist Theron Johnson is away for this edition. Cobb County Democratic Chair Michael Owens returns to fill in. Hey, guys, welcome.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Dennis.
Let's start, of course, with the ongoing drama over Georgia's gubernatorial election, but there are other races as well. Counting, recounting, lawsuits. Brian, I'll start with you. With charges from Abrams that Kemp is trying to suppress the vote, and from Kemp that Abrams is trying to undermine democracy, are we looking at some real long-term damage to our faith in the system here?
You know, Democrats were all over Donald Trump in 2016 when he questioned the legitimacy of the election before the election and after. They said he was hurting democracy. Apparently, only Republicans are supposed to be graceful losers. Stacey Abrams has lost this race. There are not enough votes out there to switch it over. They are being irresponsible, and they are hurting our democracy, and they are hurting faith in the system.
But shouldn't every vote count, even though there are not enough?
Who is saying it doesn't? Every vote has been counted.
There are provisional ballots out
there still. Count them. Hey, it's fine. Okay. I mean, the federal judge came out and said continue counting those ballots, and I don't have a problem with it, and I'm not worried about it because there are not enough of them out there to change the difference. Brian Kemp is the governor-elect, and there is drama going on, but it is empty sound and fury. There is no substance to what they are saying. The rhetoric from the campaign manager is over the top, and it is destructive. And when she says that he is the master of suppression, that is filled with racial and racist overtones. You know, my colleague here, Theron, says that calling Abrams's agenda on the campaign trail radical and extreme were racial code words. Balderdash, it was not. That's surely about policy. What they are doing now will sow racial division that is destructive, and they need to quietly stop and move on to the next race. They're obviously setting up to run against David Perdue or for some other office. So go focus on that and let us get on with the transition and let Brian Kemp build his administration and get ready for his inauguration and the State of the State address.
Well, I'm kind of blown away with that, Brian. I don't recall her saying that Brian Kemp was the master of voter suppression. I remember saying the architect of voter suppression, but either way it goes, we can succumb to him being both of those. The fact of the matter, though, is in this, democracy has to play out. By saying all votes have counted, we know all votes have not been counted. So what we do want to do is make sure that every vote is counted. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that. There are Marines, airmen, soldiers that are abroad that have voted, and their votes deserve to count as well.
Sure.
So having this sense that votes are already counted, like dismissing votes that are out there. Look, we wouldn't be in the situation if our former Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, had not run such a shoddy job, just just calling it out there, if he had not ran such a shoddy job at protecting voter election integrity, because most people, not just Democrats and Republicans at this time, day and time, have a serious concern about the integrity of the elections that are being held in Georgia. That is crossed any partisan lines at this point. This is an issue that affects everyone. When there are faulty machines or old machines or machines that have compromises or have the ability to be compromised because they have not been maintained or refreshed as they should be, that affects every voter, not just Democratic voters walking into the ballot. Every single voter is affected by that.
Is it just, though, the Secretary of State's office here? Because the argument has been made that we do have an antiquated voting system with no paper verification. But we're also in the middle of a counting process that has been very slow, partly because the machines are antiquated and get overloaded in the recount in some places. Are we looking at plenty of blame to go around when it comes to the state and to the counties in funding a real, live, verifiable, up-to-date, not just voting, but counting system?
I think Republicans and Democrats would agree that we have tremendous investments needed in our election system. We are falling behind. And I think part of it is we were coming out of the Great Recession where every budget was getting cut. The Secretary of State's office took a particularly deep cut during those times. And as we were rebuilding that funding, that wasn't the priority. And now we're at a place where we're more flush with cash. And I think it's something that we do need to prioritize. It is important for our democracy. But I'll say this. I do want to respond to what Michael said, that if Brian Kemp was the architect of suppression, then he did do a shoddy job on that because Democrats showed up in record numbers. They are registered in record numbers. They knocked off numerous House incumbents, state House incumbents, and took over two state Senate seats in this last election. Democrats had just as much access to the polls, just as much access to registration, and they showed up. And, hey, congratulations to them. They got some pretty big wins, you know, including in Cobb County where Michael is chairman. Good for them. So let's have the Democrats celebrate the way democracy worked for them and quit undermining our democracy with not only with challenges and rhetoric, but baseless and destructive challenges and rhetoric.
Going back to your original question, Dennis, I think there is a funding problem. We know that there is. We've also had, increasing growth within Georgia all over. So, particularly in the metro area. So when you look at situations to where, you have a large amount of growth and we have not had the investment at the county level. We can really talk about this at the county level.
It's easy to blame the state, but the counties fund their local election offices.
We should put this where it belongs at the county and extrapolate on that a little bit more with the Board of Commissioners to ensure that the County Board of Elections are getting funded as they should. So there's definite issues there, and I agree with Brian. Every county has to put priorities on what they're going to put on there, but we should go back to the Secretary of State and Secretary of State's office to make sure that those priorities are being put on there, and the Secretary of State's office is also responsible for leading that direction in the future where votes go. And lastly, I'll say Brian Kemp, and I've given Brian Kemp kudos as where it may be in the past because, being someone from a cybersecurity background, I understand the challenges that come with securing systems when people are constantly trying to attack. So I think I've given him a good bit of liberty when it comes to some of this, but I would still like to see exactly how the Secretary of State's office, not only under Brian Kemp's watch, but the next Secretary of State is going to make sure that they're doing the necessary due diligence to make sure that all voter information stays safe.
And that brings up a runoff coming up on December 4th. But just to wrap up the Secretary of State, the current Secretary of State's question, Brian, very quickly, you opposed Secretary Kemp during the primaries when you were working for Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle. In retrospect, should Secretary Kemp have stepped down as soon as perhaps before that primary or even as soon as that primary was over?
Yeah, I think it's funny that this question gets asked so routinely because I can assure you it would not be asked if he was a Democrat. It is a complete double standard. There are secretaries of state across the country routinely running for other offices who maintain their office and oversee the election. It is a giant bureaucracy. There are many county-level powers involved. It would be impossible for that position to rig an election or some way tilt the balance in his favor. It's silliness, and If he wanted to stay in the office, I think it's perfectly within his purview and perfectly ethical for him to have done that. I think it's wise for him to have stepped down now so he can focus on the transition and get a third party in there, Robin Crittenden, as the interim to oversee these runoffs. What I hope to see in these runoffs, and I want to go into this more in depth for our podcast listeners who perhaps are a little more nerdy when it comes to digging in on politics, because I wish that we lived in a world where Brad Raffensperger and John Barrow were having an open conversation.
They are running for Secretary of
State. They are the finalists for the Secretary of State. I would love to hear them have a nonpartisan, non-ideological talk about how we improve our voter system. I want to see us move to a ranked voter system where we have automatic runoffs when we go to vote once. It will save tax dollars. And as an added benefit, if you have to go in there and rank candidates, it is much less likely that you're going to go negative in your campaign because you don't want to alienate the supporters of your opponents.
And when you're saying, just to clarify, when you're saying ranked voting, in other words, voters can go in and say, this is my first choice, and if there's a runoff, this is my, and my candidate doesn't make it, this is my second choice, and you do that all at once. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Okay. So you can go in there and say, Brian Kemp's my first choice for governor, and Ted Metz is my second choice, and you know, by default, Stacey Abrams is your third, or vice versa if you are perhaps a Democrat. So you have the built-in runoff system on the first go, and so we save money on the runoff, which are painful. Everybody hates having to raise money for them. Everybody hates having four more weeks of commercials and mailers and door knockers. And it's not efficient, particularly when you have like open seat special elections to have a primary, a general, and then a runoff. I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy for some of these offices. So I want to see ranked voting because I think it would take out some of the toxicity in our elections. And I want to see some improvements in the machines that we have because we have fallen behind the rest of the nation.
I think what would help is if we have more competitive seats. And we get rid of whoever's doing the gerrymandering or whatever you want to call it. I think
so. You're saying, I mean, the Carl Vinson Institute at the University of Georgia, for instance, has been mentioned as a place where the redistricting job could be left.
Independent commission because talking about bringing down the toxicity in elections, once it becomes closer to 50-50 where you actually have to speak outside of your core base to get elected, I think that will do a lot to be able to tone that down. And from the other aspect, I look at a lot of voters across the large swath. I think a lot of times we get kind of caught up in our own minutiae and our own political bubbles where we know all the candidates, we know everything that's going on. But the vast majority of people do not have access to candidates as we do. They don't know backgrounds and histories. And to a lot of them, they're only starting to pay attention, you know, right as the election is upon us. So, you know, to go into a ranked type system, will hurt democracy because a lot of those people who have not been paying attention won't have the full scope and idea and to say, yeah, we're going to go into a runoff and they're going to know who that secondary and third person is. I just don't think that's realistic. They won't actually know.
It's working in Maine. And there was I read some great pieces over the summer because it's sort of new there. And I do think it's going to be a learning curve. But I think Georgians are smart enough to learn. And I think it's particularly helpful in a primary where it's your party and those are races where there aren't big differences in the candidates on the issues because the candidates know what Democratic electors want to hear or what Republican electors want to hear. And so it's personal. And that's where you get the most nasty, visceral, personal attacks is in those primaries. So I'd love to see it. It's working in Maine. And the stories coming out of it are showing that candidates running there did lessen their attacks on the others because they wanted this to be the second and third choice of the voters who support the other candidates.
There was an old saying in politics decades ago, as Maine goes, so goes the nation. We'll see if that happens
Bring it back these days.
Let's move to the runoffs very quickly. Secretary of State has suddenly become a high-profile race, partly because of the dispute over how Secretary Kemp has handled things. Michael Owens, Democrat, John Barrow is a former congressman. Republican Brad Raffensperger, strong in the northern suburbs. Does Secretary Kemp become an issue when there's an open seat and the whole idea is how do these guys handle things going forward?
I think Secretary Kemp is, is already a mainstay when it comes to this election and how it's going to play out. And this is one that, you know, I've looked at the entire time. I think probably my background in technology and cybersecurity, dealing in international cybercrime, really hits home with this, because this is a key issue. And this, and I go back to say again, this is not a Democrat or Republican issue. This is an issue that we're dealing with where, you know, Brian Kemp, for better or for worse, there's lots of questions around twofold. How safe has he been in protecting the data of our 6.9 million voters? And then secondary, you know, we need to keep up with the technology and spend the money. So, you know, looking at this going forward into the runoff, to me, it's all about talking about how the next Secretary of State is going to be a good steward of all of our information. That's going to be the key element to me is when it comes to voter integrity, and not from a from a radical racial type thing, from a core sense of we have personal information that the state collects that we need to ensure that is safe. And it's as simple as that. And to me, the candidate that can most concretely express their ideas and ideals and vision about how they're going to do that will be the one that wins this race.
We don't see candidates talking about the issues that matter in that office, in the Secretary of State's office. And that suggests to me that they see data in polling, et cetera, that people don't have strong feelings or don't have much knowledge or much desire to even discuss how we reform our electoral system and the other functions that the Secretary of State oversees.
Let's take a look at some of what we referred to a little bit earlier. Michael, the Democrats, as Brian mentioned, did very well in places like Cobb County, where you are.
All because of Michael. I mean, he did it. I mean, he's by himself. He's wielded the sword there and cutting on the weeds.
They did very well in places even where you probably didn't expect they would do well.
Yeah. I mean, thank you, Brian. Appreciate it. We did a fantastic job over this 2 years, and particularly in Cobb, where people thought maybe 2016 was a fluke when Hillary took the top of the ticket there.
But where were you surprised?
Where was I surprised? As someone who's called for this blue wave for 18 months nonstop, I can't really say I was completely surprised by much of anything.
Are you surprised Brian won? Since you called for the blue wave?
When he was talking about specific parks within the state, right? I think, looking at what happened in Cobb, what happened in Gwinnett County, Douglas County, again, I think swept all the races. Henry County, we mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. Henry County continues to become a stronghold for Democrats.
So Democrat or Stacey Abrams won in Newton County.
And I was going to say Newton County was one. If there was a surprise, probably seeing that one go. And the surprise would be the amount in which Stacey Abrams won by in these areas. You know, like in Cobb County, she won over 30,000 votes. And as these additional votes continue to be counted, she's continued to increase that lead in Cobb. So, you know, it's not so much the areas as much as the velocity in which she's won some of these races.
But there were parts of Cobb where Democrats did better than they expected.
You know, that, again, as far as me being chair of my executive committee, that was our job, right? The first and foremost thing we did was Democrats had a lot of candidates, right, in Cobb and throughout the state. So anytime you're going to have more candidates on the ballot, we did a great job recruiting and having women stepping up to run in offices. So when you do that, you know, we can now start to challenge these races across the county. And as we know, every single vote counts. Like I got that plug in there, Brian? Every vote counts. So in every part of the county where there's a candidate that's running, that's going to do us bid us well in races across the state.
Brian, Republicans, though, have relied on the suburbs. What's the message for them going forward when they see even precincts where they have won before in some of these suburban counties either closer than they expected or going Democratic?
I think 2016 foreshadowed a lot of what we saw last Tuesday. You saw Hillary win Gwinnett and Cobb, and you know those are big watershed moments. But this time you saw the Democrats increase their margins in those counties by significant amounts. And you look in at precincts in wealthy, highly educated areas of Buckhead and North DeKalb and East Cobb, and you really see tremendous growth for Democrats driven, I would imagine, largely by college-educated white women who have their reservations about the president or maybe even are moving away because of issues like guns, et cetera. So The thing is, Georgia's not an anomaly. We're not like doing something wrong here, and that's why we're losing all of these Republican women to the Democrats. This is a national trend. You're seeing, one, the so-called browning of America. We're getting much more heavily minority, and Democrats have a built-in advantage there that Republicans must chip into if they're going to be a force, a viable party moving forward. And you're seeing college-educated women particularly moving to the Democrats, and but also just with college-educated people in general moving more toward the Democrats. And that's what you saw. Like my precinct is a heavily white precinct, and Stacey Abrams won it by 3 points. And Donald Trump won my precinct by 100 votes. So you see on the edges there, my precinct is a great bellwether for what's happening in those inner
suburbs.
You're
in the Brookhaven area.
Yeah, I'm in the Brookhaven area, yeah. So our strategy, and Brian Kemp didn't have the luxury of running in a race in the future. He had to run in a race today. And he went out and said, where are the Republican votes? Where do we need to turn out our people, people that we know are going to vote for us? And so he focused on the rural areas, and his strategy worked. It worked by a hair. And Brian Kemp knows, and the team, the smart team of advisors around Brian Kemp knows, that that's not a strategy that can work again. Now, you know, Stacey Abrams showed that we have reached the tipping point, so we've got to go get those suburban people back, and we've got to get some minorities.
Does that mean that if Brian Kemp takes office as governor, that he then goes back on the promise he made during the primary to sign a religious freedom bill, for instance, mm-hmm. which has turned off not only many suburban voters, but companies?
I think that's going to be a really tough thing to navigate. I know that even in the general election, while Kemp was very smartly not talking about that on the campaign trail, that he was still saying in meetings with donors that he wanted to get that issue off the table and sign it. And it's going to be a major pressure point for him in this first year. And there is a lot of politics to maneuver there. And we, of course, have a burgeoning movie industry here that would be crippled if that happened. And I'm not saying that to be for or against that legislation. I'm just saying those are the realities. And companies like Marvel and Disney that film at Pinewood will leave the state. And we've got the Super Bowl coming in. Is that what we want people talking about for the week that we are the center of the world's attention? And it's really tricky. I'm glad that I don't have to make those decisions.
Could he expect, perhaps, Michael, a friendly Republican committee chair to just bottle that up and keep it from getting to the floor he won't get put in that position?
I would expect so. When we're talking about the issues and talking about the issues and how we're able to move the patterns, if you will, within the voting electorate, what's happened is within a Democratic Party, we've made a concerted effort to talk to everyone about issues, not looking at where there's white voters or where there's black voters, because our goal is to talk to all voters. And that's how we can go into Brookhaven and Vinings and North DeKalb and win by large margins. White women are not coming out to support the Democratic Party because just we're saying we're the nice people. We're talking about issues. And one key thing is that, you know, as Democrats, and particularly when you start talking about, well, when Lucy McBeth won, right, the 6th congressional district.
That was my surprise, by the way.
Now, here's what happened. It's a surprise to those who weren't closely involved with that race. I set up the 6th congressional district task force January 24th, 2017, with a specific goal to win that race. Our goal with that was to go out and talk to everybody, you know, across the landscape, rich, poor, black, white, it didn't matter, because we're going to talk about the issues of the race. And that's what Lucy McBeth was able to do, go out and talk about those issues specifically. Look, we're in a state where, you know, 70% of the people want Medicaid expansion. Right. So if you're willing to talk about that, guess what? People are going to actually respond. So, you know, when it comes to being able to move these electorates and being able to get in these areas, you know, that I mentioned before, it's because we're able to go in and talk specifically about the issues.
Where Michael is half telling the truth there is Democrats did reach out to Republican voters, because I got Democratic mail in the 6th congressional district for 2 months. I got more from the Democratic Party of Georgia than I did from Republican candidates, even though my wife and I are Republican super voters.
Because we know the Republican message is not working.
And so you're talking to my wife.
People who used
to be Republicans. You're talking to my wife, not me.
So there were Republicans that used to be that went out and voted for Lucy McBeth, and we thank you for that contribution, because that's how, in addition to all of our Democrats that got activated, We had a little help as well, and we appreciate that.
Like the Republican mail to my house is to the Robinson household. The Democratic mail was very specifically to Mrs. Robinson.
Because
they were not talking to everybody. They were talking to a target audience just like we were, just like every political campaign does with limited funds.
So they were saying, here's to you, Mrs. Robinson.
Which actually, this week was my wedding anniversary, and that was a song that we used when we were leaving the wedding.
Happy anniversary.
Yeah.
We will be back with more of the Political Breakfast. Stay right here.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
We are back with the Political Breakfast. Good to have you with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Theron Johnson, our Democratic strategist, is out this week. In his place, Michael Owens, Cobb Democratic chair, along with Brian Robinson, Republican strategist and public affairs consultant and former deputy chief of staff to Governor Nathan Deal. Very quickly, guys, let's pick up on what this election means for the congressional delegation here. You've got a bunch of Democrats who have been in Congress for a long time in Georgia. You know, in Georgia, we used to have this feeling, and it was bipartisan over the years. Everybody from Richard Russell to Sam Nunn to Newt Gingrich to Tom Price, these were powerful Georgians in Congress. The Republican bench at the moment is mostly full of folks who've been there relatively recently, especially with the departure of Tom Price. Meanwhile, the Democrats have a bench, with the exception of Lucy McBath, who just got there, folks who've been there a while, John Lewis, Sanford Bishop, Hank Johnson. These guys are going to have
David
a voice.
David Scott, really.
David Scott, yes. Yeah. Didn't mean to forget him. These are folks who are going to have a voice. Michael, I'll start with you. Hank Johnson could head a judiciary subcommittee that oversees the federal courts. That means he gets possibly involved if they go after, investigate the firing of Jeff Sessions, for instance. John Lewis on Ways and Means could be involved in the probe of President Trump's tax returns. We mentioned David Scott on agriculture. He's been very influential there already. Sanford Bishop also on agriculture. You have an agriculture secretary from Georgia. Mm-hmm. And even the Republicans, Doug Collins, got a shout out from the president this week on prison reform.
Yeah.
So the Republican influence isn't totally lost, but the Democrats, because of their seniority, really have a place where they now have to make decisions on where they weigh in and when.
Yeah, I think that is definitely one upside that we look at ourselves now as Democrats taking the House, and if we bring this closer to Georgia, where we have four Democrats that's been in office for some while, and now we add Lucy McBath to the mix as well. And from the Republican side as well, you know, from Sonny Perdue there, and obviously David Perdue and Johnny Isaacson. So we have a contingent. When I look across the state or as a state, Georgia, I'm proud of the fact that Georgia is going to potentially be at the epicenter of a lot of what's happening in Washington, D.C., and I think that's a good thing for our state.
The fact is, we are a purple state, and I don't say that to boost the esteem or egos of Democrats or to downplay my side. It is a warning to my side. Yeah, it is a call to action for my side that we cannot use the same playbook. And I've been talking to leaders in the Republican Party here in the state, and they get it. Up and down the ballot, they get it. And I was really hearing it from Metro Atlanta Republicans in the General Assembly before the election. They were seeing the problems at the doors when they were knocking. And many of those who came to me worried did actually end up losing their seats. So we've got to make some changes. We're going to be a focus of the presidential candidates in 2020 when it's presumably President Trump against some extreme liberal from the Democratic side who's extremely angry about something. We don't know yet who it's going to be.
Of course, President Trump is never angry about anything.
Never angry.
No, he's a voice of calm and reason.
Oh,
and,
boy.
And we should remind Brian that he said in 2016, President Trump would not be the nominee of the Republican
Party. Yeah. I was pretty emphatic about it.
You should have been.
Take that. Well, you know. that'd be the nominee. I give the guy credit. He's proven everyone wrong over and over again. And what's remarkable is that it looks like he will win re-election at this stage.
Has he reached the point of diminishing returns, though? As we've looked at the patterns that we've talked about earlier in this podcast, shifting votes from traditionally folks who leaned at least Republican to leaning Democratic.
You know,
and if you lose a state like Georgia, and if you lose a state like Arizona, mm-hmm. and if you lose a state like Ohio that you won before.
But I don't know why I would lose Ohio.
Okay, let's pick another one. Say Florida. The path gets narrower.
Florida, North Carolina.
The Electoral College.
The path was extraordinarily narrow before. I think we saw things saying that Hillary Clinton had a 97% chance of winning, something like that. I talk about a narrow path. I mean, he did it, and he did it by winning with an 80,000 vote margin combined in three states. So he's got to have a similar strategy. He would lose the popular vote again because of the huge liberal population centers in California and New York and others. And he's going to get electoral votes in small rural states like Wyoming and North Dakota, et cetera, et cetera. But he's got to hold states like Georgia and Florida. There's no path without those.
Let's quickly move to the special session here in Georgia. Delta Airlines tax breaks, fuel sales tax break, is on the agenda. Now, this was passed years ago, back when the airline was in bankruptcy. Of course, Delta's doing nicely. Thank you. Third quarter profit, $1.3 billion. Brian, does Delta still need that tax break? And it did get involved in another controversy back when Casey Cagle, for whom you were working during the primary, decided, okay, we're going to hold up that tax break for Delta because of its position ending the discount for NRA members.
Yeah, not great timing to try to get that passed during a heated primary election where that was an issue that could be used by either side. It just wasn't a great time for something of that scale. This issue is not about Delta. This issue is about Hartsfield-Jackson and our other airports. It's about competitiveness with airports in Texas and North Carolina specifically that don't have the jet fuel tax. If you look at how high ours is, it is more in line with what we traditionally see as high tax states. Mm-hmm. And our airline leaders, and of course here that is Delta, have said, if you take this action, we will increase the number of direct flights to international and maybe even domestic locations. You know, flights directly daily to places like Shanghai are hugely important to our economy, and to be able to grow in those areas is something that brings direct jobs and investment to our state.
So but that wasn't the argument they made at the time.
Of course not.
Right.
It's a lot easier to give an emergency tax break than it is to get rid of one.
Yeah, it is a different argument now. We're not in a great recession. They're obviously making billions and billions of dollars. But I'll say this for Delta as a corporate citizen. They also reinvest in this state. They are the state's largest employer. They give back here tremendously, and they are important corporate patrons of our state.
I have friends at Delta. I've consulted there before, and I think Delta is a fine company. But we're looking at $40 million in the tax break. And Delta's doing quite well. Now, you know, to expand routes, look, it's a hub. The fact of the matter is, I don't think without a serious issue, Delta's going to pull up stakes and go anywhere, right? It's possible they could go back to Minneapolis, but I don't see that happening, right? Delta's going to be here.
Minneapolis was where Northwest Airlines was, and Delta took over
Northwest.
Yes,
so, I mean, Delta is a fabric of Atlanta. I think it's part of what makes Georgia, Georgia at this point in time. So I think there's a way out of this without huge corporate tax breaks. I think we'll figure it out at the end of the day.
Yeah, here's the thing. In the bigger picture, this goes well beyond. You're seeing a lot of pushback in D.C. and New York City from Republicans and Democrats, if there aren't any Republicans in New York City and D.C., that this is corporate welfare for Amazon. We saw the huge payouts going to one of the world's biggest, wealthiest companies. And there's a growing populist backlash to corporate welfare in this country or corporate giveaways, et cetera. And that is a issue that Republicans and Democrats can seize upon. And, you know, Donald Trump is actually uniquely qualified and uniquely situated to grab the reins of that populist issue and make a difference. We'll see if he's willing to do it.
Let's look at Amazon. Speaking of big employers.
Yes.
Amazon decided not to come to Georgia.
Huge mistake. Huge mistake, Jeff Bezos.
We've learned now what the state offered Amazon. Quick list, $1.3 billion in tax credits, another $320 million in sales tax breaks on construction, $100 million in state money for the site, another $87 million in City of Atlanta tax breaks, $2.2 billion in city infrastructure investments, an exclusive airport lounge for Amazon bigwigs, 50 free airport parking spaces for them, and a private car on MARTA.
Sorry. Here's where I look at this and go, we have to have more self-worth as a city and as a state, right? I think there's a lot to offer any company, domestic or international, that's looking for a home. I think Atlanta is a fine city. I think Georgia is a fantastic state. And I think this is where we have to put a package together. But at the same time, the companies have to realize that you're coming somewhere that is geographically great. You're coming somewhere where it has a high skilled workforce. You know, there's lots of good, great schools and universities in Georgia. So I don't think we have to give away everything to be able to attract these companies.
I would push back on Amazon's claim that part of our shortcoming was we didn't have enough tech workers. Well, we do. And I used to live.
Well, we have a state public education system that continues to struggle in state by state rankings, mm-hmm. although it has improved some.
Do you K through 12?
K through 12.
Yeah, that's true.
K through 12.
We have talked a lot about transportation as one problem that perhaps Amazon was looking at, infrastructure.
Yes.
But is education really part of the key to that, since looking at the areas where they did go, there are a lot of highly trained workers there?
It's always key to that. And I'll tell you that whenever an executive, and I've been involved in some M&A stuff in the past and relocations, and whenever someone's looking at going to a place, if I always joke that if the executive doesn't, whoever their spouse is going to go and look up those schools. You know, and if schools are not 8s, 9s, and 10s, there's going to be high reservations about going there.
Of course, most of these folks are going to put their kids in private school anyway. The people making these decisions aren't necessarily putting their kids in public schools in a failing system. That would never happen. There are excellent school systems here, including the one where Michael lives, including Gwinnett County, mm-hmm. which is now a majority minority county and still kicking butt in the test scores. So we have a lot of great schools here, and some that are well below where they should be. And that was one of the emphasis of Governor Deal over the last 5 years, is helping those kids trapped in those failing schools. I think if Amazon was here this week during the rainy rush hours, where Atlanta turns into a post-apocalyptic dystopia, where you lose hope that you're ever going to get home, and you consider just ending it all in your car, just running into a guardrail of the interstate, if you can make it to the interstate, I can see why that would hurt their view of Atlanta. But our public school system, this is in the university level, is excellent. We've really risen to the ranks in the last 20 years with the advent of the Hope Scholarship, Tech and University of Georgia, the alma maters of the two gentlemen sitting here, are now two
we
top 20.
We have Yellow Jackets and Dogs represented.
We have two top 20 public education systems, schools in the country here. And Georgia Tech, of course, their innovation center is phenomenal. And Georgia State and Kennesaw State now are adding to that. UGA is adding to that. We would have the workforce that they needed, and they would have found much lower home prices here, a much higher quality of life. Crystal City and Queens were expensive before Amazon got there. What's going to happen now? Where are normal people ever going to live? How are you going to get janitors and drivers and food servers anywhere near those areas? It's ridiculous.
Very quickly, the question has been raised. Brian, I'll start with you. If the state had this kind of money to throw at Amazon and to offer it to them, doesn't it have the money to invest more in things like education, infrastructure, and all that? If it can find the money for Amazon, can it find it for those things and perhaps an updated voting system?
It's a false equivalency there, because we do investments in these corporate relocations and groundbreakings because they pay long-term dividends. You're bringing in people who are going to be paying income taxes, people are going to be paying sales taxes, and people are going to contribute to the local economy in many ways. And so it's different than one-time cost in other things. I, as a Republican, do believe in government investment in infrastructure that improves our economy. I believe in funding our ports and our airports, our roads and our mass transit systems, and expanding broadband to every corner of the state. Those are things that pay dividends. Yeah, it's harder to make that argument with some other social spending. So do we have the money? Well, we only have the money if it's going to pay off in the long run.
Of course we have the money. It's a matter of where we decide to put it and where our values are as a state. But I agree with Brian. I do look at it as an investment, right? And it's where you invest in that. So, you know, we've had the same thing with SunTrust Park, right? In with the Braves, and people can argue back and forth either way. But you know, there's this halo effect that studies have been shown, right? That outside of just the Braves, you know, you've had a tremendous amount of economic development area, and this all came from the Braves. So, you know, anytime you're looking at this, I take a larger look at it, but I do think Amazon missed out on a great opportunity by coming here. But I think it also tells us we have to do something about our antiquated transit system here in Georgia, because we are far behind anyone else in the country and the state, I mean, and the world for that matter.
One other quick point, and I'll start with you, Michael, because you're a technology expert, and I want to give credit to Stephanie Ruhle of MSNBC, who has raised this question repeatedly to cities that were in the hunt. Georgia and all the other states gave away a ton of data to Amazon for free. Mm-hmm. Not just Atlanta, it's all the cities that were in the hunt. Should we take a second look at that when we're courting companies in the future? Because Amazon just got an incalculable amount of data, it would be hard to put a value on that.
Yeah, I definitely think that we should. I mean, it's, you know, it's one of those things where you're looking at 50,000 jobs, I think, right? So anytime someone's talking about coming in—
Or 25,000 now.
25, yeah. And 25, yeah. I think they say. Yeah. 25 in New York and 25 in Virginia. But again, I think anytime you're talking about, you know, numbers and opportunities and dollars and that amount, there is the willingness to kind of overshare information to be able to try to land that deal. And I know, you know, from doing many deals, sometimes, you know, you have kind of have to back off of that, you know. And so it is a concern. And you're looking at Amazon, as we already know, is one of the world's most largest purveyors and consumers of data anyway. So they have very savvy ways of which to collect it and then which to do things with it. So I think, again, back as a state, I think we have to become more savvy. I know Governor Dill has done a fine job with economic development, I think, in the state. But, you know, number one in business, but we have to be number one in smart business. And I think there's a difference there.
My biggest regret is that I sold my condo in Alexandria, Virginia 4 years ago. Huge, huge mistake that I didn't have more foresight. But as far as mass transit here, you know, we are expanding. We have invested in MARTA expansions, and Gwinnett is now looking at getting a line going there. There'll be a March referendum that should, and I hope does, pass. Our region needs that expansion.
At this rate, there will be a colony on Mars before there's significant expansion in MARTA.
There's bad mass transit on Mars, too, though, I bet.
Final thought here, and it's a bit of a change of pace, something to celebrate in the sports world. Atlanta and the area, which used to be called Losersville some decades ago, is Losersville no more. You've got UGA and Tech football heading for a collision, but both doing well, Tech after a rough start. You also have postseason honors for the Braves, Rookie of the Year, Manager of the Year, Atlanta United advancing in their MSL playoffs. Tata Martino, the coach who's leaving, is MSL's Coach of the Year. Atlanta United also the most valuable franchise in Major League Soccer after just two seasons. So something's going on here that Dogs, Jackets, Five Stripes, Braves, even Falcons can be happy about. Hawks, too,
Falcons,
I suppose.
As well.
Hawks are building.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to hold my breath on the Falcons, but I'm happy with what my Yellow Jackets have done. I mean, we had, you know, some big victories over Virginia Tech and then Miami. So, you know, so winning record, I'll take it. And, you know, I don't know about those Dogs, but I'm looking forward to that matchup coming up soon.
I have been ranked, actually, as the number one Dogs fan. I don't know. It's not come out yet, but I will be getting that.
There will be a demand for a recount.
Yeah. So I will say that the dogs are on the upswing. Glad to see the tech holding water, essentially floating sufficiently. And the Braves have really turned it around. This really exciting thing. SunTrust Park is an amazing venue.
Phenomenal venue.
And Tim Lee, the county commission chairman who made that deal, eventually he will have a statue in his honor in Cobb County because he will have left such an amazing legacy that will pay for itself for generations.
Too bad that our budget can't afford that plaque anymore, but okay.
But I go to a lot of the United games, and it is an incredibly electric crowd, and we have an amazing product. And I cannot thank Arthur Blank enough for what he has done for this city and region. I do know that Dan Quinn's a great coach at the Falcons. They're going to turn it around eventually and build a great program there. There's the right people there putting together the Falcons team. But United is just has blown me away because I'm an American who's 43 years old. I don't care about soccer, generally speaking. I thought this was going to be a giant bust in a
bring an MLS here.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I could not have been more wrong. I was as wrong on that as I was on Trump's ability to win the primary in 2016.
I thought you were going to say on Trump's ability to govern the country, but
he's doing fine. He's doing great.
And that's it for this edition of The Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist and former Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Filling in for Theron Johnson this time, Cobb County Democratic Chairman Michael Owens. So thanks to you both.
Thanks, Dennis. Have a great weekend. Go Dawgs.
Thank you, Dennis. Happy to be on. Go Jackets.
And if you like this show, subscribe. And you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. It's a great way to make sure that other people can find us. And we'll be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.